Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The 2019 legislative session is entering its final weeks, and there's some question at the State House if a group of priority bills will make it to the finish line this session, or will they be held over until next year? These include raising the state minimum wage to $15 an hour, a mandated paid family leave plan, a tax and regulate marijuana bill, and legislation creating a long-term revenue source to finance water quality programs over the next 20 years. So what's the outlook for these and other important bills? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Senate President Tim Ash. Tim, great to have you here.
Thanks, Bob.
So let's start off with an issue that this morning you and the chairperson of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Senator Kitchell, unveiled a plan to expand Medicaid dental benefits. What's the scope of this expansion and why is it so important?
Well, Bob, I think across the state it's pretty well understood that there is a real crisis in access to dental services. And this is not the stuff that makes major headlines, but emergency rooms at the hospitals frequently tell us in the legislature that people are showing up with avoidable pain, avoidable problems related to, you know, dental failings. And it's because it's really hard for people either to access a dentist or afford to go to the dentist. And so what the legislature and the Senate in particular in this case is looking at is doubling the annual cap for the Medicaid dental benefit. So what does that mean? Right now, if an adult on Medicaid goes in, let's say they need a tooth pulled because they're in a lot of pain, that pretty much runs up against the annual cap. If there are other things that would be appropriate to take care of right then on the spot, it's tough luck because the cap has been reached. If you have one dental cleaning, that can pretty much take up the cap. So then if you have dental pain later, you can't. The only place you can turn usually is to the emergency room or you just go through the suffering involved. So by doubling the cap, we create a little bit more capacity to get the right dental work done on the spot, but we also provide two cleanings that do not count towards that cap each year. So this is probably, in my opinion, from the point of view of our Medicaid program, with the exception of kids who we've done very well by in our dental program, the largest expansion in probably 30 years, even though the cost to the state on an ongoing basis is a fairly modest $500,000. And I should add, and this is to me as someone who's worked in senior housing, approximately 18,000 senior citizens who are eligible both for Medicaid and Medicare will now have access to the services as well.
Do you think this is a case where if you spend a little money now, you're going to save more money down the line?
It absolutely stands to reason that would be the case. I was down in Rutland, and the facility that provides dental care to people of modest means there who work very closely with the hospital indicated that something on the order of 1.5% of all the emergency room expenditures are related to avoidable dental care. Emergency rooms are obviously very expensive. So these are very small upfront investments, which will prevent those really costly episodes down the road.
And so will this be added to the Senate Appropriations Bill?
That's exactly right. So it's in the budget that we expect to vote on in a matter of hours.
Today in the program, our guest is Senate President Tim Ash. Your questions, your comments as the issues come down to the final weeks of the session, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Let's take a look at the legislation that increases the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Passed in the Senate earlier this session, it's now being reviewed by a number of House committees. And there have been some big questions that have come up about this bill. The Joint Fiscal Office showing that passage of the bill over a five-year period will create about a $70 million shortfall because of Medicaid health care workers and their salaries being affected by an increase in the minimum wage. Were you aware of this situation when the Senate passed the bill?
Well, I'd put it in the proper context because right now we have a mental health system and a visiting nurse and home health system. This is where people go in and take care of people who can't leave the home and provide really critical health services. That system across the state, which employs many thousands of people and is almost predominantly state funded, these workers are often working right now for $11, $11.50 an hour. these agencies have a tremendous time recruiting people, retaining them, because the work is very hard and the pay is very, very poor and inadequate. So what the discussion really is not about, is it, you know, if we increase the minimum wage, will that suddenly create new societal problems? What it reflects is that if we start expecting of ourselves as a state payer and other payers, will that in turn lead to what they call wage compression? This is the idea that if you raise the pay of someone who makes $11 today to $12 tomorrow, the person who was making $11.75 might need to go up to, say, $12.25. This was a problem that's been well understood. Businesses have the same issue when they maybe raise the starting pay of entry-level positions and then they have to do some adjustments. But put it in the context of a more than $1 billion Medicaid program, and I think this is something that is more of a red herring to call for inaction. And really, the consequences of inaction are much, much worse.
Well, you still have a pretty large hole. $70 million over a five-year period sounds somewhat significant.
That's a number that came to the Joint Fiscal Office, effectively self-reported by a number of agencies about what they would do or what they suggest they would do if they were required to pay an increase in the minimum wage to their employees. Those numbers will get fine-tuned, and I can tell you I'm pretty sure they're going to come way down. But again, the status quo is that adults, tens of thousands of adults, making $10.78 an hour, they are not high school kids. Many of them have kids and are the big breadwinner in the family. And people have to ask if that's an acceptable amount of money to expect an adult to live on in Vermont in the year 2019. The answer is obviously no.
So what about Governor Scott's concerns that this is going to raise a big problem along the Connecticut River Valley, where in New Hampshire the state minimum wage is $7.25, and he's looking at vetoing this bill?
Well, it's an interesting theoretical, which we actually have an interesting case study, which might suggest that won't be the case. Over the last 2 years, the legislature has increased the compensation of people who work at our so-called designated agencies, the agencies in each community that provide mental health and substance treatment services. So the starting pay at those organizations is now $14. And what happened is many New Hampshire residents started applying for those jobs because they knew that they couldn't live on what they were being paid over across the border. That increases the amount of activity on our side. So I am very confident that a very gradual increase, bear in mind, without even touching the minimum wage, it keeps going up with inflation. What we are talking about is approximately $4.50 over a five-year period for people who are making very low wages today.
So when all is said and done and the 2019 legislature adjourns, will a bill increasing the state minimum wage be passed?
I hope so. I expect it to be so.
And it faces a gubernatorial veto.
Well, the governor had said, I believe, through his chief of staff, that if they got the same bill they got last year, the legislature might expect the same results. So the House is going through that process of looking at the bill now. We don't know quite what's going to come out of the House. But my expectation is we will send a minimum wage bill to the governor's desk. And in a state that rightly is concerned with affordability, and this and every previous governor that I've served under has talked about affordability on a daily basis, I cannot think of a single thing to make life more affordable for tens of thousands of adults than increasing the minimum wage.
Was there any effort to try to work with the governor on this issue so you don't face the same outcome that you had last year?
Well, the committees that worked on the bill, there were obviously administration officials in there. The extent to which they weighed in was probably fairly limited because we know the governor hasn't been very enthusiastic about a minimum wage increase. And they're up there in the House now, the administration officials, trying to help guide their thinking on this. So my hope is in the end we'll make sure we make an increase. If you put it in the perspective, $10.78, a buck is almost a 10% increase in 1 year for people who desperately need additional resources.
Let's talk to Sarah, who is calling from Putney. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to let you know that I'm really appreciative of the fact that you're addressing dental care with the Medicaid in the legislature this year. My two children are both on Medicaid, and we could not find a dentist in Windham County that would accept new patients with Medicaid. They're our current dentist doesn't, mostly because they said that it takes the state too long to pay them back through the Medicaid program. And so currently right now I use my HSA account in order to get dental care from my kids. And because I'm lucky enough to have an employer that uses the HSA. So I think this is a really important issue. I'm glad you're addressing it.
Sarah, thanks very much for your phone call. Just to be clear, does this proposal increase the reimbursement rate for dentists?
The reimbursements, I do not believe it increases the reimbursement, but it increases the amount that a dentist can actually provide and get reimbursed for. So in that sense, you'll have more dentists who are more likely to be at the table willing to serve new Medicaid-covered dental individuals.
Another big issue coming down the home stretch is paid family leave. It passed over in the House. It's now being considered in the Senate. What's the outlook for that bill?
Well, our Economic Development Committee has been looking at it since it came over from the House. It is a different bill than what passed both the House and Senate last year. And so that's why it's taking a little bit longer for the Senate to review it. I expect the committee will vote probably on Monday. They're coming in on Monday, and my expectation is they'll be voting it out of that committee. It has a few more stops on the road. And I think the real key here is the legislature really believes we should have a universal paid leave program. The governor has suggested a voluntary program, which would not, by definition, be universal. So both the House and Senate have an interest in getting this done, and we'll have to figure out how to marry the two proposals once our committees get through their work.
Is it a matter of figuring out what length of time should be included in the leave and how much of a salary should be reimbursed?
Yeah, and which types of family incidents should qualify. So bonding care for someone who's just had a child, I think both the House and Senate are uniform of believing that must be in there. Tending to a parent or a immediate family member who's gravely ill or dying. But then there are other potential instances where someone may be able to access the benefit, and I think that's another variable. For instance, if the worker, him or herself, has a particular illness or condition and has to be out of work, and it's not something that would qualify for, say, workers' compensation.
What about the concern that there are going to be some low to middle income people who aren't going to be able to take advantage of this because they can't exist on 80% or 90% of their salary, and yet at the same time, they're going to be paying what is probably about 0.5% of a payroll tax?
Well, it's a very important concern, and one of the great improvements in this year's bill is to substantially increase the wage replacement for people who are of modest means, low and moderate income, giving them approximately 90% wage replacement. For people whose income rises above a certain level, they would get a smaller percentage of their higher income. But that is the fundamental question about a uniform or universal insurance plan at a very nominal sum of, could be a dollar a week in that range. Someone would know that should something happen in their family, they have this benefit that they can rely upon to make sure that they can still pay their bills, still meet all the family needs while they're out of work. So it's an important concern, but it gets to the heart of a universal insurance program and making sure that when you need it, it's sufficient for you to meet your family's needs.
As you mentioned, the governor is supporting a voluntary plan. He wants to put it together with the state of New Hampshire and then have state employees in both states serve as the initial pool for that program. Are we looking at another situation? We just talked about the minimum wage, the governor likely to veto that bill. Paid family leave, he doesn't like a mandated program. Are we looking at the legislature passing another bill that he's just going to veto?
I hope not. I think this universal insurance program would benefit if both the legislature and the governor reached an agreement. I think the administration is holding back a little bit until they see the shape that the Senate bill takes. As I say, the bill that the governor vetoed last year was substantially different than what the House passed. So I think they're probably keeping a close eye on what comes out of the Senate committees before they weigh in and see if there's some space for negotiating. And I think as someone who has served in the legislature, not every day is equal. A first day of the session in January is not the same experience as a day here in the last weeks of the session, where you cram a lot of negotiating and talking and reviewing into a short period of time. So there's still plenty of time for both sides to figure out a way to get to common ground.
Let's talk to Lee, who's calling from Walden. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the program.
Hi. My concern is about the minimum wage bill. One of the things that's always bothered me is that minimum wage and a livable wage are really two different things, and that a teenager working a couple hours after school at a grocery store doesn't really deserve the same level of pay as a head of household working full time at a skilled job. Is there any way of incentivizing companies to pay full-time workers more while still allowing retail stores to hire, totally unskilled young help at a lower rate?
Well, in our existing law, which has been in place for many, many years, there is a provision which allows employers to hire high school students during school vacation at a lower wage than the normal minimum wage that applies to all other adult workers. So many employers do utilize that provision in the existing labor laws. I think there are other employers who don't even know it exists, and we probably have to do a better job making sure they understand that. But one of the benefits of the minimum wage is it's not a complicated program. It doesn't require a huge bureaucracy. It's just a legal wage that must be paid. And once the amount changes, that becomes the new law and the new normal. And so one of the worries we would have about getting intricate and trying to compartmentalize different age groups and different sectors is that each time you do that, you create a new bureaucratic structure that has to figure out how to enforce it. And one of the beauties of what we have today is that we've got one minimum wage. People have to pay no less than that. And that's the end of the bureaucracy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Senate President Tim Ash. We're looking at a bunch of issues that are coming up in the final weeks of the legislative session. Let's talk to Bob, who is calling from Walden. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Senator Ash, I would just want to thank you for all your good work that you do. But I'd like to raise the point that we've been hearing about clean and clear for decades in regards to Lake Champlain. The way I see it is that there are three main areas that need to be addressed. Number one is the antiquated sewage treatment plants that spill their waste into Lake Champlain. Number two would be the developments that do not account for runoff from roofs that flow down into Lake Champlain. And finally, and perhaps more importantly, are farms that are allowed to hay right up to the riverbed and oftentimes manure into those rivers. It would seem to me that a simple fix would be to support farmers. They need the support anyway, to create 50-foot, at least 50-foot buffers, paying those farmers for taking out land, taking hayland out of production on an ongoing basis. And I would like to hear your comments on that and wonder whether the Democrats have enough huevos to pass a law requiring at least 50-foot river buffers. Thank you.
Well, I'm not a fluent Spanish speaker, but I think I got your meaning. I'll start by saying that the water quality efforts, and you referenced, Bob, Clean and Clear, which was a Governor Douglas-era program, but it's all been part of one journey of trying to improve what have become quite troubled waters. And I want to be clear for the audience that we're talking not just about Lake Champlain, although that is obviously the biggest body of water, because people who are in the Connecticut River, who are in the Upper Valley, who are in Bennington area, all over the state, there are waters that are in trouble, and the efforts we're trying to make apply across the board. So that is really important. I don't want people thinking that the money that you pay into the state that goes for water quality is just accruing to protect Lake Champlain. There are, and I will not pretend to be a farm expert. We have required the largest farms to undertake a whole bunch of new on-farm practices. We have actually boosted the Agency of Agriculture staff by about a dozen or more in the last few years to go out and be on farm doing visual inspections and enforcement and working with farmers on technical assistance. We've added some additional folks at the Agency of Natural Resources who complement that work as well. So in terms of best practices, which include buffers, I can't say with certainty just how we've addressed that, although we have certainly been pushing people away from the direct river or stream beds. I have a particular running route in the Burlington area where I live that used to take me through Ethan Allen Homestead into the Intervale area. And for years on hot days, I would reach a bend in my running route and there'd be cows right in the water and I would see them doing all the things that cows do when they eat and drink. There's an in and an out. And after passing new regulations and requirements for farm practices, just a couple years later, there's a fence keeping those cows a safe distance away from the water. So we've seen improvement. We obviously have more work to do. And this year we're still working on a way not only to improve the delivery of services to make sure that we've got the right practices in place, but our finance committee is doing its part now to figure out, working with the House Ways and Means Committee, how to help pay for that in an ongoing way.
So when that water quality bill did pass the Senate, it did not include a funding source. You said the House was going to do that. I remember you saying on the floor when some people said, hey, where's the money? You said something to the effect, well, if this bill comes back from the House with $1 million or $2 million in it to help fund water quality efforts, you were going to be embarrassed. I think that was the word that you used. What about a funding source for this? What can folks look for?
Right. And the context of that comment was to say that before we get out of here this year, we will have a funding source to pay for a range that is significantly higher than it was in previous years. In the old days, we were spending in the order of $25, $30 million a year, and now we're up in the $50 to $60 million a year range, and sometimes that gets lost. So to me, there's really two key pieces. First, the goal is cleaning up the lake and waterways. And so the Senate's initial bill was about the process of sending out professionals and working with farms and developers and others to actually clean up the lake and waterways. From a timing point of view, what we said is we need to keep thinking about how we're going to come up with the money to do it. And so working with the House before we leave, we will have such a plan.
Do you think philosophically that the tax should be something that everybody pays a little bit about, or should it be defined more to people who have an impact on the lake or the other rivers and streams?
My primary emphasis is that it has to be a simple source of revenue that has a relationship to the pollution itself in some way, and that will get signed by the governor. Because lost in some of the advocacy is the fact that the governor has not warmly embraced many of the kinds of revenue proposals that some of the advocates would like to see. And so we have to also be realistic about how we work with the governor to get to a funding source that we can all live with.
And I think his original funding source was the estate tax.
Yes. It was to divert money that comes in from a small number of high-value estates each year. What that did was created a pretty significant gap in the rest of the budget to meet other human needs, to help do workforce development, to help, you know, get kids into dual enrollment programs. All the other things that are in the budget got shorted as a result of that movement. So as I said at the time, the governor had a proposal. We don't like it. It's now our job to finish the session with something we like better that we think he'll sign.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Alan, who's calling from Wheelock. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind today?
I'd like to know what they're going to do about the property taxes. If they're going to put some of this marijuana revenue towards it, the property tax cannot be funded by cannot be funded by our property taxes. It's outrageous.
Okay, Alan, thanks very much for your phone call. You know, when the session started, there was a lot of discussion of right now about 70% of homeowners pay their school taxes based on their income and not the value of their property in the income sensitivity program. There was some talk about let's expand that to include everybody? It doesn't seem to have gone anywhere.
It's a proposal that has been floated, at least conceptually, every year that I've been in the Senate, and it usually runs into two challenges. One is the more people dig in, they realize that, as you say, approximately 70% of homeowners already pay based on their income and have some adjustment to reflect their ability to pay. To go to a completely income-based system has some risks associated with it. Particularly high-income individuals are more able than their less resourced counterparts to change their residency and other things. So there's a risk factor if you put all your eggs, to use the English version of one of your caller's Spanish expressions, into one basket. So there hasn't been a great amount of discussion about that this year. I think there has been a lot of enthusiasm and well-received news about districts across the state who have been working together under their new configurations to achieve savings. I think the fact that the property tax rate this year appears like it will not go up are all factors maybe that made those who most strongly believe in a 100% income-based system maybe take their foot off the pedal a bit.
Alan mentioned some revenue from a marijuana bill if that happens to pass. The Senate gave its strong approval to the so-called tax and regulate plan. I think you've done it now five or six times in the last few years. It's got some opposition over in the House. Are you going to be disappointed if this bill doesn't pass this year?
Well, it'll be disappointing, but you know, I don't show up in Montpelier at the beginning of the year thinking that the single most important objective is to pass a legal marijuana market piece of legislation. I believe it's the right thing to do. It's the more rational way to approach a substance that's used by tens of thousands of Vermonters on a monthly basis if we believe the analysis that's been done. That said, my primary emphasis is getting out of here with a very good and strong budget that people can afford to pay and that takes care of people's needs and builds for our future. You know, those are the real key priorities: meeting people's human needs, education needs, transportation, taking care of our vulnerable population, including seniors. If the marijuana bill were to fail, I'd be disappointed for sure, but it is not in my top 10 list of priorities.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Dave, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. I had a question whether or not the state of Vermont would enact a law that says if you're running for president of the United States, you have to have already filed your taxes. And I think that might be really important for Vermont, so that we can then be a state which says, hey, you got to follow the rules, so do it. Is that possible?
Well, it is possible, Dave, and I believe a proposal has been introduced in the House and in the Senate that would achieve just that objective, and I've perhaps more than the average citizen, I follow the news from other legislatures around the country, and I know a few states have passed it either through their House or Senate. I suspect that either the House or Senate will at least take hearings at the beginning of next year. The disposition of those, I can't say for sure.
Today on the program, our guest is Senate President Tim Ash. We're looking at some of the big priority issues in the final weeks of the session. Your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211. Let's try another Dave. This Dave is in Burlington. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Senator Ash, I wanted to ask you some questions about the Senate's action this year when it comes to dealing with climate change, which, as we know, is an existential threat. And every single major medical association or public health association has identified it as such. I know that the House came out with a bill looking at weatherization that, while far below our state's climate goals, did something. Can you give us an update on the Senate's bill? And also, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about why the Global Warming Solutions Act, which aimed to actually hold Vermont to its own greenhouse gas standards, didn't succeed.
Sure, Dave. There are a few questions there, so I'll try to be efficient in answering them. The first, I'll start with the last issue about the Global Warming Solutions Act. That bill was in the House. I know they had a few committee hearings on it. I don't believe they've voted it out of the committee. And what that bill would do for listeners is basically put certain environmental goals into statute in such a way that if the state didn't hit one of those targets at a certain date, it would allow citizen groups or citizens to potentially sue the state, which is something that has happened in Massachusetts. So that's I don't know why that didn't move forward in the House, and the Senate hasn't had hearings on that at this point. In terms of the larger environmental efforts in the Senate, and some of these are just starting to materialize to the public since we're just passing our transportation and our budget and other legislation. First, I'd say in the budget that will be voted on this afternoon, we will be increasing above and beyond what the House did, the amount of money available for electric vehicle incentives so that we can get more people moving into electric vehicles faster than they otherwise would. That program will also include a new provision added by the Senate Transportation Committee, which will try to help lower-income people for whom a new electric car is not realistic at all to get into used hybrids and high-mile-per-gallon vehicles. So we're pretty excited about both of those things, which should help with our transportation emissions. On the issue of weatherization, what we have assembled is a few strategies. One is to we're putting together a budget package which will include at least the same amount of weatherization that the House has done. But then we do a second thing, which is challenge our Public Utility Commission, which regulates our regulated utilities, to do it what we call a docket. It's basically open a case or a inquiry into how we would move beyond our current electrical efficiency utility model, which people will know of Efficiency Vermont. They only focus on electricity in people's homes. How we would expand on that in the future to also include heating efficiency, the way people heat their homes. Right now, on everybody's electric bill, you pay a little surcharge that goes into Efficiency Vermont. That money can only be used to do replacements of electrical gadgets and light bulbs and things like that. We are asking them to look at how that might evolve to include heating efficiency in the future and how we might fund that on an ongoing basis. So the short answer is as much weatherization or more than what came over from the House, but with an eye towards rethinking the whole future. One of the biggest challenges we've had is that low-income weatherization is something that has been well understood. We have programs that support making the homes that low-income people live in tighter so that they're not heating the outdoors. But those of us who have spent a lot of time thinking about climate change know this is not about this is not a low-income heating issue. It's people of all incomes that really need to be thinking again about how they make their homes tighter so that they're not using heating oil or propane or other sources unnecessarily. So what we're looking at is basically thinking about heating efficiency at all income levels in the future in a way we've already done with electricity.
So when the House passed their weatherization bill, they had an increase in the home heating oil tax. Are you saying that's off the table?
At this time, the Senate will make some adjustments that the House made, which were related to who has to pay it and things like that. But the Senate's belief at this time is that we should not merely raise the heating tax because of concerns about it being a regressive tax that people, especially in rural areas, can't avoid. They have to heat their homes. So it's not to say that in the future we might not need to think about the way we support efficiency of all types differently. But at this time, we believe we can substantially increase the amount of weatherization while leaving for a future decision how we adequately fund our investments in cleaning up the environment.
We've been talking with Senate President Tim Ash about many of the Senate's priorities in the final weeks of this session. Senator Ash, many thanks for being on the program
today.
Thanks,
Bob. I really enjoyed it.